Hey there, guys, gals, and caffeinated pals. Welcome to Commander and Coffee, where we cover spicy brews, iced lattes, and every combination in between. I go by Y, but I am not alone on this journey. Please introduce yourselves.
Hey, what's up? It's Cypher.
And I'm Cork.
Today, we are covering one of Cork's brews, which he has found recent success with in local tournaments in the two-headed format. This is Kurik, Son of Yawgmoth. What makes this deck so good despite being mono black in a CEDH environment? We are going to find out. And I am not the one to answer those questions because I am not the expert. Literally anyone but me is the expert here. So yeah, you two talk and I will ask questions as we go and we're going to figure this out together.
Tune in next week on Commander and Coffee Z.
But before we get into all that though, guys, how you guys been? What's going on with you guys? What's new and exciting? I guess I'll start. I've been knee deep in the lab, just theory crafting and prepping for a Punt City. That's sort of been where I'm at, just trying to figure out what I want to play and what I want to do. Other than that, it's been pretty business as usual. Just been jamming a lot of games. I know recently been diving more into Popper and playing that. And I know we'll play a couple games with Y, learning that format. It's kind of fun too. So that's kind of what I've been doing this week. What about the rest of you guys?
I am also trying to narrow down my choices for Punt City. I feel like I'm on one of two decks at the moment, but I keep getting distracted by new updates to the decklist database. I'm really interested in trying out Thrasios Dargo. I don't know if I'm going to try playing that before Punt City or if I'm going to have enough resolve to wait until after that to try it out. But every fiber of my being wants to like jump ship and try something new.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. I really am just tournament prepping for Punt City. I mean, big prize. Got to take this very seriously. Like, I am, in like Cypher said, in the lab just 24-7 just going, well, I could do this, we could do that, I could do this. You know, tweaking the decks that I'm trying to play, testing out new ones. You know, just really kind of, well, for lack of a better term, labbing it up. Thank God for coffee, am I right? Hey.
Cork has a habit of slowly going up to a 4-color or 5-color deck until the tournament, and then 2 days before, he'll go back down to one of his 2-color brews.
It's like a house of cards. You know, you build it up so high, and then it comes crashing down.
So we'll see how many colors the final deck is on. I feel like I have an over-under bet ready.
In before I play mono brown.
That is so funny, because it's true. Oh my God. I never put that together. But yeah, you'll be on like Nigella for like 4 weeks, and then all of a sudden you'll be like, nah, I'm playing Urza. It's like, wait, what?
How did we get here? How did we get from point A to point this one? How do we get to point U with Urza? Like, what happened here?
Yeah, you turned 360 degrees and walked away.
Yeah, it's literally like, nope, I'm out. Peace. And just turn around.
Oh, man, that was funny. That was really funny. I didn't even put that together. But yeah, he's correct. That happens all the time. Anyways, today we're not talking about 5-4-3 or 2-color decks. Like Y said, we are talking 1-color.
Yeah, we have like the singularity, the black hole that all of Cork's good ideas collapse into.
It literally is just a black hole.
For those art majors, we're actually talking no color, as black is the absence of color, but that's a different story.
Hold up, wait, the art majors here.
Don't make me start. I mean, you're not wrong, but like, Nope, we're not changing the category of the podcast.
Oh no, go on, pop off.
No, I just wanted to talk about how sick like Vanta Black is and all that kind of stuff.
Yo, Vanta Black is sick.
If I ever build this commander, that's going to be the title of my list, just Vanta Black.
I love that.
And here we go.
You can play this deck as long as you certify that you are not Anish Kapoor.
I am not Anish Kapoor. I'm just saying that I can confirm that I am not working for him, working by him, being paid by him, or him in general, or portraying him.
We are looking for sponsors, though.
Ayo, what up?
Anyways, trying to get back on topic a little bit, since I was the one that forced the derailment there. Cork, why don't you talk to us a little bit about what Kurik does and what we're trying to do with the deck?
All right, so real quick, number one, the more reason I love this deck is because this deck is highly caffeinated, like me. It just goes burr. Everything it does is speed, 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 speed. It's like if you took a power thirst and then put cocaine in the can, even though it is crystal meth in the can, but that's besides the point.
I think they banned like 8 drinks just like that.
Yeah, they really did. I mean, the original Four Loko was like that too, but that's, again,
that reference is from like 2006.
Yeah, well, listen, these people will appreciate it. I don't care how old, young you are. Power Thirst is love. Power Thirst is life. Go watch Power Thirst. It's crystal meth in a can.
Please, for your safety, don't go Googling Power Thirst on YouTube. For the love of God, don't do it.
So, I am normally a stacks player. And what really got me into Kyrick, because it is the total polar opposite. Again, the total 180. It seems to be a theme in my life. Just completely 180, change everything around. I wanted to learn speed, do speed, be fast, be Sanic, do what I could do. Minus the blue. Wanted to go black. I also, speaking of minus the blue, I was using blue as a crutch, per se. It would make up for my bad gameplay and, you know, the oops, I just win kind of thing. I wanted to be able to think through my lines and everything like that, where I was actively thinking 3, 4, 5 turns ahead or 5 steps ahead, as opposed to having a stacks piece on the board that just takes care of everything, or having a, you know, counterspell that just goes, oh, whoops, okay, yeah, I just flusterstormed that and I win. You know what I mean? So that's what I really liked about Kyrick. That's what attracted me to Kyrick. Phyrexian mana is broken. Nobody can change my mind. It shouldn't have existed. It is a problem. And this just solidifies it for me. The primary game plan is, again, speed. This deck can consistently turn out turn 1, 2, 3 combos without even trying. But it is all about how you mulligan. You have to mulligan very, very aggressively. You can easily win off a mulligan to 4. It is straight up just a combo deck. It does not. It sometimes you just win, and then sometimes you go all the way down to 4 life, and one of your opponents goes lightning bolt you, and you go, "Yep, scoop them up." Next game, good game, guys. Speaking from experience,
one thing I wanted to mention is that when you go to like a linear fast combo of any kind, whether it be this or, you know, a fast nauseam deck of some kind, or even Godo, you see clear answers in the form of like stacks decks, a lot of counter magic. But another possible weakness that you might find playing a deck like this is literally your own mulligan decisions. They can kill you more than a Thalia can.
Why just recently played with me in a 200 giant event while I ran Kyrick, and that was the whole idea, was to go fast, and he just kind of sat there and ran 6 silences. And we had a lot of success. We actually went undefeated on the day and won the whole thing. But that's kind of it. The deck is very, very similar to that. There's some concessions that had to be made for the two-headed giant format. But otherwise, the deck pretty much stays true to form. And the deck that I based my brew off of is actually a faster Kyrick Storm by a one Franzi from Mythics Gaming's MTG. I've only changed, I think, 2 or 3 cards personally, because the list was very solid and I really liked it. It played very well. It everything layered together and it just made sense.
It's interesting seeing a monocolor deck that feels like it's a tight list, because normally that comes when you're adding whatever people say are the necessary staples of each color. When you're in 5 color, you only have 5 open slots because you're trying to play your Sylvan Library, your Carpet of Flowers, your Counter Magic Suite, your maybe like wheel. But yeah, you would think that with a monocolor black deck that you have a lot of options open to you. It seems like a lot of these options are commander centric as to why they're in. To an inexperienced Kyrick player, it feels like a lot of these cards are flex slots. But I know from previous conversation, as someone playing the deck, what are actually the flex slots in here? Because I mean, there's a 4-mana Diabolic Tutor in here, but I think that would be a core card, where it is a core card in no other CEDH deck.
Right. So like, what if I told you that 4-mana Diabolic Tutor is actually just a 2-mana Diabolic Tutor because of Kyrick? It's what about Demonic Tutor 2.0? The more black mana pips in the card, the easier and more free it is to cast. This deck really takes advantage of the my life total is a resource idea, and goes, oh yeah, it's 100% a resource and we're not doing anything else. That's what we're using it for. We have 40 life. It ain't zero. Let's go.
Yeah, I love how your math is such a dynamic conversation when you're playing this deck, because Beseech the Queen actually costs less mana than Demonic Tutor.
Correct. It actually only costs 6 life as opposed to that, as opposed to the normal either 6 colorless or 3 black.
What would you say makes this deck better or a contender, or however you kind of want to phrase it, comparative to these other like higher colored turbo decks, right? Like if you're talking about like, why play Kirk over something like Roger Tevish or Roger Silas or something of that sort? Some of those more colors, gaining access to the red rituals, that kind of those kind of turbo decks. Why Kirk?
Glass Cannon, and you just get there. Like Roger Tevish, Roger Silas, Roger, does stuff very similarly with the backup lines and also with protection of blue in Roger Silas sense and Roger Tevish lines. You get access to more ritual effects, which is very cool. Kirik is his own ritual effect, and he only costs 4 mana out of the command zone for colorless mana, let me mind you, and 6 life, but that's besides the point. Life totals a resource. So it kind of more or less is a ritual in itself, because you can easily pop off from, I'm going to cast Kirik, and then I'm going to do one thing and then win.
Yeah, I think it's a simple equation of like, you know, most of the time when you look at these Rograk, Son of Rogah turbo decks, right? They're utilizing their zero mana commander as a way to generate more mana with the use of things like Culling the Weak, Infernal. Oh my god, what's the
Infernal Plunge? Infernal Plunge.
I knew it. Haha. I know turbo things like Phyrexian Tower and stuff like that. Whereas when you cast Kirik, you've turned all of your black pips into Phyrexian mana spells. So now they're essentially free cast spells, or like you've like cut the amount of mana required for half of your deck in half, basically, right? Like it becomes anywhere from free to like 2 mana for like almost every spell you have in your deck with the appropriate amount of life, obviously.
Right, naturally. And a lot of that tends to just go into me being able to just jam every single tutor effect that I possibly can. Like what I said, there's a Diabolic Tutor, which costs 2 black. Any other C deck, it's terrible. In this, it's another Demonic Tutor. Mastermind's Acquisition is another one. Cards like Flesh Writhier, Grim Tutor, you know, those are amazing cards in this deck because of being able to pay that life. It's Mono Black Ramp is really what it boils down to, for lack of a better term. Probably the best tutor in the entire deck, in my personal opinion, the one that I've always had the best, I don't want to use the term luck, but like I've always been happy to see it. Final Parting. 3 black. Sorcery. Search your library for 2 cards, put 1 in your hand and the other into your graveyard, then shuffle your library. You straight up put Reanimate in your hand and Avilis in the graveyard, you're off to the races. It's a better ad nauseum right there, which I'm going to get into the combos, lions, and you know how to get there in a second.
Kirik is a ritual enabler in and of himself, but you also play ritual cards in your deck list still. Dark Ritual is a fantastic card, and it also enables you a lot of winning lines off of the turn that you cast it with 0 mana left over. You tap out for Kirik, and then you cast a Dark Ritual for 2 life, and now you have 3 black mana to start whatever chain you need.
The biggest hurdle in Kirik itself is colorless mana, generic mana, whatever you want to call it.
Well, that's the only mana you have to actually pay the normal way.
Exactly. Like, for instance, if I wanted to cast Peer into the Abyss, I only have to pay 4 colorless mana and 6 life, and I'm Peer into the Abyssing. We may not have access to counter spells in Kirik, but we do have access to a lot of discard effects, Duress, Inquisition, Thought Seize, Collective Brutality, things like that actually have a big part to be like, okay, cool. Can I go off here? Does a blue player have something to kind of stop me? Cool. No? Yes? Okay, maybe.
So with that being the case, like kind of holistically looking to sit down at this with this deck, if a listener's looking to sit down with it, what kind of decks are they happy to see across from them at the table, and what kind of decks are they like, oh god, this is a slog? Like, what's this deck good against? What's this deck not so great against?
So any deck that I like to sit across from, I love playing at stacks decks with it, because it is faster than them. Ones that I really don't like to see are actually like the Roger Silas or the Roger Tevish, because they could equate me on speed, which worries me because I'm looking to win turns 1, 2, 3. At the latest is turn 4. If I'm not going fast, I'm losing. Like in Ricky Bobby, if you ain't first, you're last. Going first and having the turn 1 win is the best feeling in the world. It's something else to do.
I feel like cards in the realm of Swords to Plowshares are cards that you might be playing around when you can.
Yeah, cards like Swords, Dothy Voidwalker, Grafdigger's Cage, Rest in Peace.
Opposition Agent,
because there's a lot of tutoring that occurs. There's a lot of graveyard recursion. There's just a lot. Yasharn's another one that's, you know, very seldom played, but also does a huge amount. Just makes me go, yeah, I can't do anything.
Yeah, it specifically annihilates you.
Yeah, that card. There's another card that does that. You can't pay life. I can't remember what it is. It's an angel.
Oh, Jubilation? Angel of Jubilation?
I think he's right. I think it is Angel of Jubilation.
I want to double check that.
One triple white player can't pay life.
Confirmed. It is Angel of Jubilation.
And that's even less seldom played than Yasharn. So I really don't concern myself with that. Counterspells, because it's very susceptible to counterspells. It's pretty much like, can I be fast? Any deck that's faster or like straight up runs a lot of counter magic is what scares me. Happy to see decks. If nobody's playing blue, I am the happiest as a clam. I literally, kid in the candy store, bike on Christmas, whatever you want to call it, that's me. I love it. When there's not a blue deck on my table, I go, I'm probably winning this. Actually, I'm winning this. You know, I will mulligan even more aggressively than I already do. Otherwise, it's a really fun deck. I always tell people the equate, like if you had to equate an image to this deck, aside from being an overly caffeinated person, the SpongeBob meme of where he forgot his name and he's searching his brain and everything's on fire and they're all running around. That's how this deck feels like I'm playing it.
Now that we kind of know a little bit more about Kirk, let's talk about how the deck wins. What are some of the combos? What's the lines? How are we going from saying you win to physically winning the game?
So a couple of the ways that you could easily just win the game. I mentioned it before. There's like a Vilas engine kind of thing when you are playing Vilas Broker of Blood, which reads pay, you know, swamp, black mana, pay two life, target creature is -1/-1 until the turn. But the other text under it says whenever you lose life, draw that many cards. So when you pay your two life to activate his ability, you're paying four life and drawing four cards to do his thing. So you are doing a better Necropotence to just draw into your deck, which then gets you into everything else. You know, life total allowance. One of the main ways that you'll see a Kirk player win is a Grey Merchant loop. Whether it's be play the Grey Merchant out, sack it with like Dimir Houseguard, pay life with Blood Celebrant to make your mana to recast to Corpse Stance, which buyback if you're running the Corpse Stance line to bring back Grey Merchant or to do just a bunch of reanimation things with it.
And sometimes you're casting Grey Merchant mid combo to refill some of your life to spend on other tutors and setup pieces, right?
Correct. Sometimes you just have to be able to bring yourself out of that hole that you're in and go from there. You also run Aether Flux in there, and because you are kind of storming off by casting a bunch of things, also that gains you a lot of life. It's like a manual storm, and then you just pew pew laser beam, gotta go, and you just knock someone out like that.
Are you still on Top Citadel with that?
I am still on Top Citadel. That's what I was going to next. Thank you very much, Y. Bolas of Citadel, since it's my top caster deck, call it a day. You got it, you know, and you go into the other decks, other loops. So one of the other combos involves Asmodeus the Archfiend, which is a 4BB legendary creature devil god with binding contract. If you would draw a card, exile the top card of your library face down instead. BBB, draw 7 cards. So therefore you drew the 7 cards all face down under Asmodeus, technically. And then you play black, return all exiled cards with Asmodeus the Archfiend to their owner's hand, and you lose that much life. So you might say, boy, how's that work? That doesn't seem too good. Well, there's a little card called Necrotic Ooze and it in the graveyard. As we all know and love Necrotic Ooze, as long as it's on the battlefield, all activated abilities of all creature cards in all the graveyards. That includes your opponents too. So if you have to be facing a mirror and you get it in there, yeah, that's pretty cool. So you basically just pay black, or in with Kirk down, it's 6 life to draw 7 cards. I think that's a pretty good double ancestral recall.
So essentially you're building your own Grizzle brand.
Literally it's build your own Grizzle brand and one less mana to draw one, the same amount of cards.
A very bad card in Commander, right? Because
yes. Yeah, we all know how powerful that is.
The important part about this combo is that Necrotic Ooze isn't copying the Binding Contract of Asmodeus. When you say black, 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 draw seven cards, they are not face down if it's done with Necrotic Ooze, because it doesn't copy the part where they're face down.
So then how does the Scourge Familiar fit into this combo?
Scourge Familiar in the bin allows you to, well, I'll just read Scourge Familiar. Four and a black, it's an imp, it has flying, choose and discard a card, add black to the mana pool, play this ability as mana source. So literally while it's in the graveyard and you have Necrotic Ooze, you just ditch cards to its ability to just keep adding black and keep drawing your deck.
Yeah, so essentially then you could transition from having to pay six life to draw seven cards and it's just discard three cards, draw seven cards.
Exactly.
And then this all becomes possible because with Asmodeus and Scourge Familiar in your graveyard, the Necrotic Ooze is a combination of Asmodeus and Scourge Familiar's activated abilities. I love that. I love Griselbrand. So anytime you can build your own Griselbrand, that is exciting to me.
Yeah, and this deck is Necrotic Ooze is a build your own whatever you want. Once you get there, you get to use cards like Chainer, Dementia Master to reanimate Necrotic Ooze. Reanimate Grey Merchant Masvidel and then sacrifice it with Dimir House Guard, and you just get to do shenanigans that way. That's the main line. In my opinion, that's like usually plan A. It all layers together, which is what's wonderful about this deck. And the fact that you have so many tutors to get to you to whatever you want is phenomenal. Like, for instance, you could just Buried Alive, you know, you put Asmodeus, Scourge Familiar, and Necrotic Ooze into the bin, and then you reanimate the Necrotic Ooze, and you just go off from there. It's that simple sometimes.
So just to clarify, your primary game plan you're trying to shoot for is to assemble this Necrotic Ooze, Asmodeus, Griselbrand combo. And then from there, you back up. From there, you kind of move into the Looping Chainer and Grey Merchant with, like you said, sacrificing Dimir House Guards. That's kind of plan A. And then plan B is typically something like Aetherflux Reservoir or Citadel Loops to kind of close out the game from there.
Yeah, it has a lot of like build your own burger type aspects to it. And that's what really attracted me to this deck as opposed to a Roger Silas type deck personally. I really liked the flexibility, the fact that I could tutor everything whenever I want and just kind of go off, and how layered it is to itself, because each card does play into itself. Like, for instance, a card that you never see anywhere is Flesh Writhier. Two black black, it's a creature horror, 3/3. It has Transfigure, which I don't blame you if you don't know what Transfigure, because I had to stare at this card for a little while and read over the text multiple times. Transfigure is basically Transmute, but on this, or on the creature. You sacrifice this creature, search your library for a creature card with the same converted mana cost as this creature, and put that card into play. Then shuffle your library, play only as a sorcery. So it literally just is Transmute just for a creature onto the battlefield. So it costs four. You know what else costs four? Necrotic Ooze. So you can Flesh Writhier Transfigure into an Entomb to just start your loop that way.
So yeah, it seems like there's a lot of ways to kind of get through the game plan here of trying to assemble one of these combos as quickly as possible. Obviously, that all starts with getting Kirk into play as soon as possible to start turning these Phyrexian mana symbols online. So with that, one of the neat things I noticed as we kind of go through our single cards and what each card's doing in the deck list is there's actually, for a deck that's Glass Cannon, there's a lot of unique removal pieces into the deck list. I think the deck has one, two, three, four, five, six at least different forms of creature removal kind of in the deck list, right? You have things like Ulcerate, Grasp of Darkness, Infernal Grasp, Dismember, Deadly Rollick, and Snuff Out. Basically just an homage to the stacks decks that are trying to slow you down that we're just trying to get rid of those cards for. Or why kind of this many of these removal spells?
So one, they're cards to cast to pump up Kirik, because whenever you cast a black spell, you also put a +1/+1 counter on Kirik. Two, there's a lot of creatures that do affect me. In particular would be like Draenith Magistrate, because if I can't get Kyrick down, I'm kind of SOL. Draenith does that. You have, like I said, the Yasharn, you know, the Angel of Jubilation again. You have one spell per turn effect, so Aethersworn Canonist, Rule of Law Bird, Archon of Emyria, things like, and all the Thalia effects too, because that adds an extra colorless pip that I can't deal with because it's so tight that I have to do it a certain way.
Looking at being mono black, right? Your ability to kind of interact like on the stack is pretty low. What's interesting here is, I think you brought this up earlier, but there's a plethora of cards that don't really see a ton of play in four player pods due to their singleton nature. But these are things like Duress, Inquisition of Kozilek, Thoughtseize, and even in some regards removal, but also like discard is Collective Brutality. What are we doing with these? Why the inclusion of these cards?
They're basically my version of counterspells. You can't counter me if you don't have the counterspell in your hand. That's it.
Knowledge is power, right?
Exactly. Being able to look at the blue player and go, you got a counterspell that could deal with me? Nope. All right, I'm going off now.
Are you ever looking to deploy these defensively? Like, what decks are you worried that you might not be fast enough?
So one of them that we mentioned before was Roger Silas. That deck is also a turn two, turn three deck. Sometimes even a turn one deck. Tevish, Roger also, same thing. Those would be like the ones that, you know, if I'm playing them defensively, I really have to be very knowledgeable at the deck in particular that I'm facing off against.
Yeah, so maybe some turn order dependence on that as well.
Correct. Like, and the other thing is like knowledge of what the players are doing. Like, so if I see somebody in blue black go Demonic Tutor and then Vamp Tutor or Imperial Seal, then I'm going, okay, they're obviously tutoring for the Thoracle combo. So I'm going to dress you and take out one of your things. You know, or, you know, Thoughtseize preferred, but that way I hit both things.
Yeah, so these aren't like your single player 1v1 vintage legacy / modern style interaction spells where you're looking to just kind of jam them down and turn one and strip some cards away from somebody. You're really trying to be as proactive as possible with them, and then on the combo turn have them act as pseudo silenced style effects, right? Where you're trying to like take a look at the person with open mana or whatever, and try and see what you can do to interact with them. But then can also be used two-faced to strip away people that are doing just a little bit too much tutoring for your liking.
Yeah, don't tutor around me.
Cool. Card draw is really interesting in this deck. As in, like, besides the like Asmodeus loops, I don't see too much in here. This deck is just overloaded with tutors, and tutors.
Tutors are effectively card draw.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, I would like to draw this one, please.
Yeah, I would like to draw this particular card. I mean, we have cards like Night's Whisper in here. Some variants tend to run Sign in Blood. So it's, you know, it's one of those type things where it's like, yeah, you get some cards, but I'd rather just tutor the card. Necropotence is technically card draw, right? Technically.
So looking at this list, if my count is correct, there are 14, excuse me, I missed that one. There are 14 individual tutor cards into this deck list. That's quite a few. That's definitely more than two. So yeah, it's definitely relying on the tutors. You have the anywhere from your broken ones everybody knows about, like Imperial Seal, Demonic Tutor, and Vampiric Tutor, through cards like Grim Tutor, Diabolic Tutor, Mastermind's Acquisition, Dark Petition, which is basically Demonic Tutor, Final Parting, Beseech the Queen. Then you have interesting ones like Dimir Machinations, which is really cool. So that's an interesting one. So that's a transmute one, typical to when people are doing things like Muddle the Mixture. What are you looking for off of this? Like, what's the bread and butter? Like, I'm casting the transmute Dimir Machinations. What are we grabbing with that?
So there's a couple different things that I like to get with that. Sometimes it's a tutor for a tutor, like going from Dimir to a Grim Tutor to make sure I get exactly what I want, or Praetor's Grasp, or even like the dismember if I need the removal spell, or sometimes you just need the necromancy just to get there, the necropotence. So it's really just the tutor for those specific targets. It's personally the one card that I'm always kind of iffy on when I see it. Like, I know its power level, because like one of the cool things you could do, and this is the whole reason I even still keep it in here, is you can transmute it to get yourself an Overeager Apprentice. It's 2 and a black. Discard a card from your hand, sacrifice Overeager Apprentice, add black to your mana pool. So what you can effectively do is tutor for the Overeager, play the Overeager, ditch like a Vilas if it's stuck in your hand, or Razaketh or anything like that. Sacrifice, add black, and then proceed to reanimate loop and do all the shenanigans from that. So it's a way to be able to get the card into your graveyard with that if it's stuck in your hand.
And these tutor chains are overall very mana effective combos, because transmute costs effectively 1 mana. If you go transmute into a Grim Tutor, that's 2 colorless mana and 8 life. And then whatever you get with that can be potentially free. But yeah, you can be casting 3-4 spells in a row. You can be tutoring for other tutors and not need a lot of mana to do that in this deck.
Can I take a minute and talk about the power, how powerful Heartless Summoning is? Because I love this card. And I'm so happy that this deck allows me to play it. So what Heartless Summoning does is it's 1 and a black. Creature spells you cast cost 2 colorless pips less to cast. Creatures you control get -1/-1. Well, thank goodness Kirik is a 2/2, so that would be very awkward. But what it allows me to do is it lets me to all my creature tutors, like Violent Tumor, just cost black. Sidisi costs 1 colorless. Priest of Gix literally says pay 2 life and Dark Ritual. Opposition Agent, same thing. You know, Grey Merchant now costs 1 colorless. Necroticus, black. Like, the cost reduction is so powerful. So any of the cost reduces, which is why I run Jet Medallion and Heartless Summoning. I love this card. Every time I see this in my hand, I am so happy, because I'm like, cool, that just does the math for me. It makes the math so much cheaper.
Speaking on Violent Tumor for a minute, you're playing Violent Tumor because you obviously want some cards in your graveyard. You're a bit of a reanimator strategy kind of going on. You know, you have the Violent Tumor, you have Reanimate. I see Entomb in here, and then I see the three big reanimate enchantments and Animate Dead, Dance of the Dead, and Necromancy. Interesting to hear your thoughts on why cards like Unmarked Grave, Persist, Exhume, those cards didn't end up making the cut.
So Exhume gets, we're going to start with the top. Exhume gets your opponent's a creature back. Now again, yes, if I'm going fast, I don't need it. I don't really care. But it also costs 1 pip extra. Okay, cool. Persist is one that I've been thinking about because it actually works with Grey Merchant a lot, and I really like that a lot. So that's the one that I keep bouncing back and forth on. So I don't really have anything bad to say because it requires testing, I'm not going to lie. And then as for Unmarked Grave, most of the things I want to reanimate are legendary except for Gary.
What about, I'm just spitballing here, what about Goryeo's Vengeance?
So Goryeo's Vengeance, actually, which was really funny, is when Y and I were prepping for the event, I actually mentioned him Goryeo's Vengeance. And he's like, well, what would you take out? And I actually said Dimir Machinations. And we're like, is it really worth it to have another one? Because that only reanimates legendaries. So I'm like, it's kind of like 6 and 1/2 dozen the other on that one. They both have the same problem. Yes, I want to reanimate legendaries. I know I just said that. But there are times when I need to reanimate a Necrotic Ooze or reanimate a Grey Merchant. And that's my biggest thing with Goryeo's Vengeance, which is why I didn't end up running it in the event.
We talked a lot about some of the more interesting ramp cards like Heartless Summoning and that. This deck is just overloaded with mana rocks. It makes total sense as a mono black deck trying to just get colorless pips out of you. Seems really great for that. Yeah, I don't see anything unstandard in here. Seems like your standard bread and butter cards there. So you have a good balance here, I think, of cards that want to go extremely fast, and then it's like some more proactive cards. Like the deck I see is playing Dothy and Oppo, which you know, to me, don't exude like fat going fast, right? They're a little more proactive, stacks cards, trying to slow the game down and interact with them. But you still have access to those in the deck. And, you know, Dothi being essentially a free creature spell to cast is always cool, right? So interesting things you can do from there. One of the things that it's interesting too is having access to, like, you know, all these tutors and everything to get what you want, but having things like Praetor's Grasp to go and steal your opponent's stuff is always a really cool card in the deck that I like to see. So I think that's all that I see in the deck list that really interests me and excites me from what I see. But it's a really interesting deck. It's very powerful. It's very fast into what it does.
Yeah, I love it. And it's really taught me to, well, A, respect the fast decks. That's number one. That was the whole thing that I wanted to do, because if you can't beat them, join them. And if you can't learn them, try them. If you can't understand them, try them. That's how you're going to learn them. Mess that one up, you know?
Yeah, fast decks have a bad rap. People tend to think like, oh yeah, it's just a turbo deck and it's a glass cannon and it dies. And I don't think saying Kirk isn't a glass cannon is a wrong statement, because I definitely think it is.
Oh god,
yeah, that deck stressed me out playing next to it.
Yeah, there was a lot of times that he's sitting next to me and going, oh, that looks like a good hand. I'm like, oh no, this cast Kirk on turn three. This is terrible. And he's like, what? What are you talking about? You have all that. I'm like, nope. I need it sooner. And like, I multi, I think, 5 the one time, and he looked at me and went, what are you doing?
No, I agreed. I encouraged you to mull lower that one game, remember?
Yeah, that, you know, you're right. Because I was like, this is a safe hand. He goes, do it.
Yeah, I had a hand with like a silence and a counter spell or something like that. Like, I had a nice protection hand. I'm just like, just find your win. Find your win. I got you.
Welcome to my world. Yeah, like these fast turbo decks are so much fun to play, but like your mulligan decisions and the hard parts of the deck list aren't like memorizing the combo and the line is easy, right? That's the basic stuff. It's the mulligans and the do I go now? Do I wait a turn? Does it get better for me? Those are the decision points at each point when you're playing a deck like this that you really want to be kind of locked into, right? Because you're going to see a lot of games where, you know, like how many blue mana producing lands are untapped, like, really helps determine like kind of where you want to be and what you want to be doing, right? Because again, if there's none, that reduces the amount of interaction quite heavily to what can stop you versus, you know, a blue mana open or so that's the hard parts in these fast combo decks. But I do like to see though that you have some regards in here. You're not playing full glass cannon, right? You do things like Oppo and Dothi to try and interact with the table and help out for something else that's going on while still kind of trying to line into these busted cards and win the games.
Well, what's cool about Oppo and Dothi is they actually work into my game plan. They help me out quite a bit, because if I flash in an Oppo agent on someone's fetch land, I run very, very few lands, 28 lands. I mean, that might seem more than normal with all the mana, but that's with all the mana rocks and stuff. I'm more likely to keep around a 1-2 land hand. If I could cast Kirik and start to go off, I don't care. So if I cast an Oppo and take someone's fetch land, that's great. If I throw a Dothi down, people sometimes will just cast protection into it just naturally. And I'm like, that's great for me. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you and all your contributions to my cause. Would you like to join the Phyrexians?
First of all, 28 lands is low. Come on, I play 25 in my decks. Back off.
Look at me. I missed your. I play 25 lands. Fight me.
I will whenever you name the time and place. Anyways, looking at your land base, one of the interesting things that's interesting to me, and I'm curious to your thoughts on it, is the deck actually has quite a significant amount of non-black producing lands. I think there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. There's like 9-ish, like if you're counting Phyrexian Tower and like Nykthos and stuff like that, of lands that don't just come down and tap for black. 17 swamps, obviously, to round out with an addition of like an Urborg and a Lake of the Dead. But how have you found your mana? Like, are you really like aggressively looking for black pips, or is it really just colorless that you really need? Like, you're not really like aggressively needing the black pips in this deck, because that just feels a a lot of colorless cards.
I really don't care about black pips because it's I could literally run waste and it doesn't really matter. Because the black pips are taken care of by Carrick himself. He pays a life for it. It's just the colorless that I really care about.
Yeah, it's just an interesting thing when I looked at it. I was like, he's not guaranteed to have black on one. That's interesting. So I guess Swamp is like one of the worst lands in the deck, right? As weird as that is to say.
Yeah, as weird as that is to say, it's probably the worst one. I mean, Lake of the Dead has its downsides sometimes too, because of how it works. But most of the time, like, I'm really unhappy to see like a Swamp in my opening hand and nothing else. Like, I really want to see like a Crystal Vein, Ancient Tomb, City of Traders, things like that. And I'm like, I'm okay with this. Yeah, anything that produces more than one mana is phenomenal. Urza Saga is like the one exception because it immediately ramps into like a Sol Ring or a Mana Crypt or something to get me. It turns the one land into two colors. And I can also float a pip as I go and search for it as well. So that's pretty cool. Hey guys, I'm running a little low on my coffee here, and I need to be very highly caffeinated for this. Can we take a little coffee break?
Hey, I forgot about that. Yeah, it's good segue.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's take a break and let's talk about what we're drinking today.
Ah,
is that you miming drinking some coffee?
Yes.
Wow. Oh, this coffee sure is good. Yum, yum.
That coffee, nom, 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 coffee.
The coffee that I totally didn't have 8 hours ago.
Spoilers. Jeez, you're giving behind the scenes look at how we...
Yeah, we live like this. Like, I could get up and make another cup, but like, maybe after this recording, I think I might do that, though.
No, for sure, because I need to eat dinner.
Oh, you're feeling
some popcorn is not...
Like, yeah, post-dinner cup of coffee, like a post-dinner espresso, I could be in the mood for today.
You could take out my espresso machine, clean it, and make it then.
I might. Don't challenge me.
Challenge.
Espresso is the Keurig of coffee.
Anyways, what are we drinking today?
In order to get up and function like a person this morning, Quirk and I made, it is a Honduras Reserve Guama Danta. This is from Four Monkeys Coffee, located in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. I wish I had more of a history with the place, honestly. I did my whole undergrad at KU, and I'm working on my master's there now. And literally, they showed up as I was leaving campus. Like, I was in my senior year, I think, when they opened, or at least when I heard about them. And it kills me that we didn't overlap as much as we did, because I would have loved to have made this place my main cafe, my home shop. But that being said, it's a great little store, and it's also where I bought my AeroPress, and I also bought like more of them for gifts and stuff too. So it's a really cool shop, and I believe they are also part of the local co-op, so it's more than just good coffee from them, and I really appreciate the place. This coffee, according to the bag, it says it's got notes of cocoa, dried fruit, and toasted almond. To me, I got a lot of that almondy note to it. Kind of in the body of it. If you've ever had like a marzipan or an almond flavored something else, like a pastry made with almond flour, I shamefully overestimated how much was left in the bag. So I go to pour it into the pour over, and I am short on coffee, and I yell, "Cork, help!" And what did you even? You tossed me something to top it off with. What was it?
Oh, it was. I had a bag of a Black and Brass espresso blend that I had a little bit left in, and it was just perfect.
Yeah, we just needed a little bit to top it off with, and I'm just like, yeah, that'll work. So I guess we'll add to those notes. It was notes of cocoa, dried fruit, toasted almond, and espresso. So hey, it turned out well.
Absolutely, and I'm definitely down for another cup soon.
Yeah, well, not that it's gone. It may be gone forever now. I'll have to see if there's any more next time I'm down that way.
Hashtag not sponsored.
Yeah, okay, so that is what we're drinking today.
That is what we are drinking today.
I'm terrible at transition.
Now the coffee is nice and warm in my hands. Let's check out some openers.
Okay, so the way we're going to do this is we're going to read off the opening hands. And because this is a It's a very specific kind of combo deck. I'm going to do my best to read these in an order that's easy for everyone listening to follow along. I'm going to start off with mana sources and then get into the more complex cards at the end of the hand, so it's a little bit easier to understand how much mana we're working with on a given hand. Did you talk about what you're looking for yet?
I mean, speed. Just as much mana as I possibly produce. That's really what I talked about.
Okay. So yeah, that's the gist of what we're looking for. So maybe like a tutor, some fast mana, early commander, turn one, turn two, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'll know the hand and I'll be able to talk through it.
First hand of the day, we have for our lands a single basic swamp all on its own, doing its best in the world. With that, we have a Lion's Eye Diamond, a Rain of Filth, a Duress, Beseech the Queen, Dismember, and Dark Petition. So let's see, we have two tutors. We have that proactive counter magic in the form of Duress, like you mentioned before, and an LED. Can we make anything out of that?
So right away, the answer is no. This does not cast you Kirik on turn one, turn two even. It only produces you one mana effectively, because to even be able to cast Kirik, you'd have to ditch your hand to the Lion's Eye Diamond. So I'd instantly pitch this.
I was going to say this technically casts Kirik on turn one. It just, you don't have any hand afterwards.
Right. You have no follow up with it.
Look, if you're memeing, this is a great hand. You go Swamp, Lion's Eye Diamond, cast Rain of Filth, sack Swamp, sack LED. Play Kirik, no hand, no field, but Kirik, go.
Go.
Yeah, this is a pitch. This is not good.
We're going to be doing a lot of these, by the way. Case in point, I think. Second seven, we have two swamps, Ancient Tomb, Lake of the Dead. And with that, we have a Chrome Mox, a Buried Alive, and a Razaketh.
So this is another pitch right away, because while it does get me a turn to Kirik, it has zero follow-up.
We going down to six.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, I do I need to read the hand? Is that
absolutely
just all, like, you have all the context you need after hearing that. So okay, cool. So we have two swamps. We have an Arcane Signet, a Grim Monolith, a Diabolic Tutor, and an Imperial Seal. Oh, there's also a Jeweled Lotus.
Yeah. So this hand is really neat, in all honesty. Because it gets me a turn one Kirik with an Imperial Seal, which would then set me up to be able to cast a Diabolic Tutor on the second turn with, you know, whatever I got from Imperial Seal. And in all honesty, what I'd probably get from Imperial Seal is a Final Parting.
I would set me up the rest of the way. Maybe Final Parting. Yeah.
Yeah. It's 100% Final Parting from here, because I will have enough mana to go and cast the Final Parting with everything, because I could then tap the Grim Monolith into the Arcane Signet, have two mana, Diabolic tutor for whatever else I need, and off to the races.
I'm gonna stop you there. This is a six. You gotta put something back.
Oh, you're right, it is a six. I totally forgot. I would pitch a,
because I've been in the Signet.
I've been in the Signet. Yeah,
I was just about to ask, do you even have a chance to cast Signet?
No, it's been the Signet here.
Yeah, this is good, but like your line is like Swamp, Lotus, Crack for Kirik, Imperial Seal, and that's where I was thinking through. Like, part of me wants to go and get like Mana Crypt. Other parts of me are like, do I go and get like a Ritual? Or
yeah, because I mean, Final Parting is the go-to. That's like your initial thought. But are there pods where you would consider, I don't know, like Appear into the Abyss rather than that, or maybe like Buried Alive, or some kind of other haymaker that the deck has?
Again, I just want to go fast. You know, Peering in the Abyss would be like the only other consideration, but it costs one extra, and I'm pretty tight on mana the way it is.
So is this a hand where you go, not counting what you draw, obviously, right? Just mm-hmm. core hand. If you go put the Arcane Signet back, Swamp, Lotus, Kirik, Imperial Seal for Mana Crypt,
mm-hmm.
draw Mana Crypt, cast Grim Monolith, tap Grim Monolith for three, use two of it, cast Diabolic Tutor. Grab, so you have one floating plus two swamps. Grab Citadel and just slam Citadel into play and then see where you go from there.
So what if I told you it's even easier than that? You can easily go Swamp, Lotus, cast Kirik, cast the Imperial Seal. Now, you could either do A, put the Final Parting on top, or B, put the Bolas of Citadel on top. I'd go, in my opinion, I'd go the Final Parting route, because then you draw turn two, you play your other swamp, you cast the Grim Monolith normally, then you tap the Grim Monolith for three, cast the Final Parting, bin Villas, grab the reanimate, reanimate Villas, you're off to the races. With the idea of using the Bolas of Citadel line, you actually run into the chance of hitting land. You just run into the chance of hitting a land.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, like, you're restrictive on the amount of creatures you have in play, because like you could like stack kill your Villas or stack kill your Kirk in response, but then that seems sketch city. But yeah, I mean, I guess it just gets there. Yeah, that just gets there.
Well, just remember that when you reanimate Villas, because you lose the life after the Villas enters the battlefield, you're immediately drawing 8 cards.
Yes, that is true. Yeah, that's probably just a little faster than mine. Okay, yeah, I'm good.
That really didn't take long. I was expecting to be going down to 5, but but yeah, the great start. We stopped at 6 already. Okay, so again, fresh opener. We have 2 swamps and a crystal vein for our land. And with that, we have a Mana Crypt, a Vampiric Tutor, an Ulcerate, and Necromancy. So, I mean, I'm seeing a possible Reanimator line here, but is it enough, even with Mana Crypt? I mean, it is a turn one commander, yeah?
It's turn one commander into a Vampiric Tutor to put, like...
with an Ulcerate for protection.
Something on top, and then, yeah, like, you put, like, a Final Parting or something like that on top.
So, you could either do Final Parting, or you can literally just grab the... no, not Buried Alive. Oh my god, my brain just stopped. Entomb. You put Entomb on top.
Oh, because you already have the Necromancy. But like, yeah, I mean, you could do that either way, right?
Yeah, this is a very dangerous line, but Kirik lives on danger. His middle name is Danger. He's Kirik Danger, son of Yawgmoth.
Well, if you put... Oh, just Entomb you. Never mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because then you have the 2 mana from the Crypt for the Necromancy. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, because I guess you can't do Buried Alive because on turn 2 you don't have enough mana, because that would be, it's 2 colorless for the Necromancy, and then it would be, yeah, you want to try to keep it to like just black pips on what you tutor off Vamp Tutor.
No, you could do Necromancy, because if you go Swamp Crypt, or no, you're going Crystal Vein, I'm sorry, never mind, you're not, you can't, I was thinking you'd have two lands on that turn, but you don't. No. Yeah.
You are untapping with only a Mana Crypt as your mana source. So your turn 2, you're looking at having Swamp Mana Crypt as your usable mana that turn.
Yeah. Can you do that though? Like, what if you went like Swamp Vampiric Tutor, and then went like Crypt Crystal Vein? It still doesn't get you there though, right?
It's literally the same thing. You're either way, you're potentially winning on turn 2.
Yep.
Yeah, I like doing it that way because you have the Ulcerate up with the Vampire Tutor. So if somebody tries to, I don't know, play a Draenith or a Thalia effect, you could just go, cool, I'm going to Ulcerate it on my... Well, I'd have to wait, but yeah.
I think it depends on table, right? Because like, there's if it doesn't matter, there's really a merit to like going Swamp Vampiric Tutor and then just going Crystal Vein Crypt Kirk, and then like, you could even like fit in like an Ulcerate from then on or something like that. If you like, depending on if you're trying, it depends on what you're scared of, right? If you're scared of Rule of Law versus removal spells on your Kirk, right? Because the first line requires Kirk to survive the table, right? But whereas if you waited a turn, you could potentially still go off from the hand, right? Like without anything in play, really.
Exactly.
Hey, remember when we couldn't find like a keepable 6 with Shorakai with like the deck with 5 more lands?
Yeah.
This is why I run 25. You don't need lands. Lands are irrelevant. They don't matter.
Yeah, I think we're just cursed whenever we don't play fast combo, or at least when we goldfish that stuff. Oh, never mind. We're okay now. This is what a 25
all is right.
This is what is it, 27 land deck should look like. We have a swamp and a bunch of things that are not rituals and are fast. It's a lot of your combo pieces, a lot of your creatures. Do you want me to name them, or should we just say like this is just clunky and unkeepable?
Please just read the hand off just so those can hear it.
Demonic Tutor and Diabolic Tutor. We have Opposition Agent, Necrotic Ooze, Aetherflux Reservoir, and Villas Broker of Blood.
So this is a pitch, obviously, because it does nothing. You know, it's like the null rod. It does nothing. And it has a lot of my combo pieces in my hand when I would prefer them in my graveyard. Super fast pitch.
So here's a fun question that I looking at this hand. Would you consider keeping this hand if there was literal just reanimate in your hand right now? Because you would have the option of that turn two reanimate Villis.
No, because I don't have Kirik down.
Yep, I was just wondering. That was just like a corner case. That was
if you replace the Villis and the Aetherflux with a way to ramp into Kirik, I'd keep it.
Second batch of seven cards. We have two swamps and an emergence zone. We have a Dismember and Snuff Out, so two removal spells, a Cabal Ritual, and a Peer into the Abyss. So we have some protection, we have a ritual, and we do have one big Haymaker that effectively should end the game. But does it cast Kirik fast enough?
It does not cast Kirik fast enough. That's the problem here. This is a turn...
It's a turn four Kirik. You need to draw land.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I can easily do a better six. We saw it in the first try.
Almost there. I think it just needed like one more fast mana source.
Yeah, 100%.
Okay, so this will be our six card hand if we keep. We have a Swamp, a Culling the Weak, Reign of Filth, Jet Medallion, Necrotic Ooze, Peer into the Abyss, and Snuff Out.
Nope, hard pitch. I'd rather do five. There's really nothing that it does for me at all.
Yeah, a little bit clunky. You don't have anything for Culling the Weak yet, so a little bit awkward to get online here. So our five-card hand, Drill Lotus really just does shore up a lot of stuff, huh?
It sure does.
yeah, we have the deck where like Drilled Lotus and like Crypt just like, yeah, okay, cool, the hand's keepable. Like, just over.
Yeah. I mean, it's an easy thing to say that, oh yeah, Drill Lotus makes every hand good, but like, this is one of the... I would say one of the de facto decks that Jewel Lotus, this is where the ceiling of Jewel Lotus is in terms of the format.
You hit a Jewel Lotus and then the rest of your hand is free. Like it literally in and of itself makes every spell in your hand free.
Correct.
Like it's just busted.
Yep. So going on to read the whole hand in context, we have a Swamp, a Nykthos, Shrine to Nyx, Jewel Lotus like we just talked about. With that, we have Entomb, Reign of Filth, Opposition Agent, and a Grasp of Darkness. And this is our five card hand, so we're going to be pitching two of them if we keep.
This is a really interesting one. I would probably keep this. It is a turn one Kirik with also having the Entomb to put one of my creatures into the bin. I also get a turn two Opposition Agent, so I could try and get something else off them. The cards I would definitely keep is Jewel Lotus, Entomb, Opposition Agent, Swamp. Those are the four core cards I'd keep. I'm just kind of torn between the extra land, Grasp of Darkness, Reign of Filth. I'm definitely binning the Reign of Filth. Reign of Filth's definitely going to the bottom. And I think I'm going to risk it for the biscuit. I'm going to keep the Nykthos in this case.
Keeping Nykthos does allow you the Opposition Agent, because if you keep Grasp of Darkness, then you don't have turn two Oppo.
Right. Yeah, that's 100%. I mean, it is a slower hand, but the fact that I have a tutor and I have potentially somebody else's tutor kind of makes it a little bit better for me.
Yeah, this is one of those hands where, like I was alluding to a little earlier, that like it does play it and it's something to consider in the deck list, is having things like Opposition Agent make like a hand that could be like extremely explosive a little clunky, because like if the Opposition Agent was like a tutor or like card draw or, you know, anything to that effect, it kind of makes the hand go a little more nutty, right? Than
absolutely
being an Opposition Agent in and of itself.
Yeah, because you are still looking for not necessarily one specific piece, but you are looking for another relevant card with this hand.
Yeah, like for me, like I'm keeping this. It's a five card hand that has a turn one Kirik, but I'm not like in love with the hand, if that makes sense. Like, it's not like I'm not excited that I'm keeping this. Like, it's not like I'm like, oh shit, yeah, like that other hand.
Yeah.
Like Jeweled Lotus, I win. This is like, all right, well, I guess I can cast a Kirik and then, like, from there, like, you know, entomb something if I need to. But, like, realistically, it's like, you know, where do I go from there? I agree that I think you want to bin the Reign of Filth. I think Nykthos with Kirik in play actually does make a lot more mana.
Yeah, so, in long term, it does make a lot more mana.
Yeah.
In short term.
Between the Grasp of Darkness and the Opposition Agent, I feel like it is Oppo, because I feel like at the end of the day, Oppo like can potentially dig you out of something. Like, just like if somebody does fire off a demonic or like a Van Tutor or something like that, then you could just win the game from there. So I think I do like the same vibe, but like, yeah, this is, for me, it's like I'm looking at Oppo and I'm like, I don't know, do I want to play this card in the deck?
But so like, here's the thing. Yes, there are significantly better fours, but this is a safe five.
You know, I agree 100%.
In terms of important things that your hand can do, it does what I think is the most important thing of early commander.
Yeah. Early commander, and it has a tutor effect. It has a game plan afterwards is the biggest thing.
Right. And what I'd really like about Kurik specifically is it really shows the flexibility in your lines that your commander opens up for you. Because in a lot of decks, you have to debate on when you're casting this Entomb in your hand. Because normally, you know, it would cost one of your, you know, one of your black sources to deploy. With Kurik in play, you can cast that anytime you would like. You're not priced into casting it when you have mana open, because you always do. So you can be waiting as long as you need to know exactly what card you're getting with Entomb. You have, yeah, it just gives you a lot more time to make your decision, because otherwise in a normal deck, you'd be debating, if I don't cast Entomb now, then I have to wait another turn cycle because I'm looking to cast Oppo Agent. And you just get to do both anytime.
Almost anytime. Yeah, it's kind of a little awkward doing our normal routine of drawing the hands, because a lot of it plays off the other people and the next steps after the seven, or after, in this case, the five. So we're doing our best here, guys. Appreciate you sticking with us.
Yeah, so it looks like we're settling on keeping this five.
Yeah, oh yeah, 100%. Yeah.
In our final send-off for Kurik, our opener is Swamp, Ancient Tomb, Mana Vault, Animate Dead, Dismember, Imperial Seal, and to shore it up, we have a Collective Brutality.
So this is a really interesting one. I'm actually really happy that we got one like this. So technically,
very diverse hand. You do a lot of everything.
Yeah. If the Imperial Seal was any other type of tutor, per se, we win from right here, which is really neat, and I like that a lot.
Walk us through that line, if that were to be a, let's say, demonic tutor.
Even though this hand is a turn one Kurik, you're not going for that this particular turn. If you don't want to, you can hide it technically and still win the game. Your primary game plan is you can go turn one Tomb Vault into Kurik, but like that's a line Imperial Seal. Then I like just going like Swamp Imperial Seal, and then you can put like Villis or anything like that into the top of the library. Then on turn two you draw the Villis. And then you go Ancient Tomb into Mana Vault, tap the Mana Vault, cast the Kurik, and then you cast Collective Brutality, escalating it to kind of start rolling through that chain there to get the discard the Villis, and then you fire off the Animate Dead to bring back the Villis, and then you have the Villis loop.
Well, you need one more mana, but yeah. No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. Yeah, I would keep this one. I'd 100% keep this one. That was a quick one. How about we do one more?
And I like how you have the dynamic protection pieces of not just Dismember, but the Collective Brutality, because you stop a counterspell, you stop an early creature. Yeah, I think having three removal spells that play into your game plan is really nice.
Oh, yeah, no, okay, yeah, you do get there if you go turn one Kurik, right? If you go Tomb Vault, Imp Seal, and then that's where it was, yeah, Tomb Vault, Imp Seal,
yep.
you lose a mana, but then you go next turn Swamp, and then you have three mana off the Tomb, or two mana off the Tomb for the Animate Dead and the Collective Brutality, and then you're off to the races.
Yeah.
Neat.
The actual final hand this time, because these two are gamblers, is two Swamps, an Ulcerate, a Mastermind's Acquisition, Heartless Summoning, Douthi Voidwalker, and Opposition Agent.
It has my favorite card in there in Heartless Summoning, but this is definitely a pitch. It's a turn three Kurik without a win in hand, so I'm, you know, I ain't about that. Like, unless my next turn, unless my draw for turn is like a mana crypt, then I'm like, yay, this is great. But yeah, no, I'm good with pitching this one.
Yeah, smells like fair magic, right?
Yeah, it does. It smells like fair magic. Yeah, that's something the Phyrexians don't do.
This is another case where I want to bring up Oppo and Douthi. While powerful cards do tend to, again, like kind of clunk up the hands a bit, and make it less likely to win. So take those cards in the deck list with a grain of salt. Very powerful and will help you grind if you need to, but do clunk up the ability to just kind of go.
Yeah, they do feel like they're bonus cards when you're looking at them in an opener in this deck.
Yeah, I actually tend to use them as like cannon fodder sometimes for Phyrexian Towers and Culling the Weaks.
Second try at the seven, we have a Swamp, Homeward Path, and Phyrexian Tower. So we have the three land hand. And with that, we have Jet Medallion, Grasp of Darkness, Priest of Gix, and a Necrotic Ooze.
Turn too slow and has no follow-up. I'm pitching this.
Yeah, I mean, you're not getting Kirigout until turn three?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
With literally zero follow-up except for a Grasp of Darkness.
Yep, easy conversation. Going to six. And this six-card hand is a Swamp, Urza Saga, Emergence Zone, Praetor's Grasp, Aetherflux Reservoir, Animate Dead, and Infernal Grasp.
Going to five.
Yep, exactly. Say no more. Five-card hand. This one is more appealing, at least at a glance. We have a Swamp, Ancient Tomb, Nykthos Shrine to Nyx, Mana Crypt, Dark Petition, Heartless Summoning, and Necropotence.
Keep. So much keep.
How much life? I mean, we'll have to play it out to see what your life is after deploying Kirik. How much life are you paying to Necropotence on turn one?
Sorry, I'm doing quick math in my head.
It makes this decision more difficult. You have a Mana Crypt, so that's like a variable amount of damage added onto that.
Before you pay any life into Necropotence.
Right, so you could straight up say that you are keeping the Ancient Tomb, the Mana Crypt, Necropotence, probably a Swamp, and you still get to keep one more card. We're on five, right? Yeah, we're on five. I would keep the Nykthos over the Ancient Tomb, or over the Swamp, not over the Ancient Tomb, I'm sorry. Nykthos over the Swamp.
Yeah, Kirik, Ancient Tomb, and then you have Mana Crypt to fuel Nykthos. That's pretty sick.
Mm-hmm. I'm just debating currently between Heartless Summoning and Dark Petition.
I think I think with the Necro, I'd rather the Summoning than the Petition, because like you're not going to be able to trigger the Spell Mastery on the Dark Petition.
Correct.
And, like, your odds of drawing a tutor are pretty high off of the Necro.
Right,
so and that's pretty easy Heartless here.
Yeah, yeah. It's
also adds to your Nykthos devotion, which is cool.
Right,
that's true. And the Heartless Summoning and the Jet Medallion seem, in a lot of cases, and a lot of these examples we've looked at so far, they look like they're better than a lot of the rituals. Like, I feel like you would rather have a Heartless Summoning than a Dark Ritual for a lot of these common lines that you're on.
I know I said it earlier in the episode, getting rid of those colorless pips makes the deck so much better.
The question is, though, like, and I think why I asked it before, though, so now we know, you know, this is the hand. You go and turn one Necro at 26 life. How much do you normally jam? Like, what's the jam number? Is it like just like six to get, or seven?
So your hand has two cards in it, three cards in it. Well, let's see our draw.
So these would go to the bottom.
Yeah, those go to the bottom. And
normally we wouldn't, but it's very relevant for this decision, huh?
Oh my god. Draw for the turn was a Priest of Gix.
So this is your turn one is this, right? Your turn one is Ancient Tomb, Crypt, into Kirik, Necro. You have three cards in hand.
Mm-hmm. I would go safely. I'm at 28, right?
26, I believe.
26. Then I would safely go to, I would safely drop 10. Easy. If I wanted to push, it'd be 15. Because that leaves me enough, if I don't hit a Gray Merchant, to be able to recoup myself.
And it's also worth noting that Nykthos is worth a lot of mana on your following turn, as well as Priest. So you're not just paying life on turn two. You have a lot of free black mana.
Your Ancient Tomb casts Priest of Gix, which gets you three, then your Nykthos and your Mana.
No, not even. You just have to pay one to cast your Heartless Summoning. The Priest of Gix is a Dark Ritual.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. You just tap your Mana Crypt for one, cast the Heartless, then you Priest of Gix, do your Nykthos thing for 3, 6, 7, 8 black, and then
yeah.
The problem is it depends on what you get off your Necro, but you should be able to win from there from your Necro.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, going at least 10 deep would definitely with the amount of, what do we say, 13 tutors?
Yeah, you're just trying to find any tutor, because literally, like, worst case scenario, you find one tutor to get Gary, and then you're refreshed, and then you can Necro again at least.
Right.
That's like as bad as you can do, right?
That was probably one of the best fives.
The neat thing with Necro, though, that is interesting for listeners for a hand like this is it does shut off your ability to discard the cards to get like the Asmodeus loops and stuff like that if you have to discard from your hand. So it does
limit. What's really cool is there's actually a Necro loop built into the deck. Because what you can do is when you discard with the Necro trigger on the stack, you can Necromancy back like one of the cards that you need. So like you can Necromancy while everything's still in the graveyard and the Necropotence trigger is there, and you can win at instant speed. So I can pitch, just for sake of argument here, Necrotic Ooze, Chainer, Gray Merchant, Dimir Houseguard, and that's it. That's all I needed.
Public service announcement. If you've taken nothing else away from this episode, Necropotence is a trigger, so you can respond with instant speed, reanimation, and other things of that nature.
Yeah, so what you do then is you instant speed Necromancy, bring back the Necrotic Ooze, use Chainer's ability to bring back the Gray Merchant, get your mana or get your life back, sacrifice it as a Dimir Houseguard, and the circus is in town.
Yeah, so you win with the Necro triggers on the stack, which is pretty
cool. Exactly. I loved seeing this five because I actually forgot to mention it earlier, so I'm really glad I got to mention it here.
Yeah, very cool. I think that was a really good assortment of openers. Like, it wasn't just, jam Kirik and go.
I mean, it's kind of jam Kirik and go.
In the background, it's jam Kirik and go, but like it doesn't always take the same shape. Like, your end destination is going to be very similar, but getting there is a very dynamic process, and that's why I think this deck is very important to get your reps in, goldfish it, playtest it. There's a lot of misunderstandings about it, and sometimes you really need to be in the driver's seat to know, but hopefully from this episode, we can get you one step closer to that car door.
Yeah, I'm crashing from my caffeine. Looks like I'm almost out of life, per se.
Yeah, I think that's a good stopping point there. I think we kind of gave our good listeners a good view of what Kirik can do and what it can do. So I think that's a wrap. So as always, guys, thanks so much for watching. All links to the list will be in the show notes below. And while you're there, please make sure to follow all of our social media platforms as well. Looking forward to seeing you in the next episode. So with that, I'm Cypher.
I'm Cork.
My name is Y.
And I'm all out of coffee.